welcoming Dr. Bruce Buchanan. He's an emeritus professor of computer science at the University of Pittsburgh. And before joining the faculty, he was also a professor of medicine and philosophy and a professor of computer science at Stanford University, where he worked on the dendril, metadendril, mycin, and protein systems. He was also a founding member of the faculty for the Stanford program, which is where I went to school, so I feel like I've been indirectly mentored by him for a long time. Dr. Buchanan holds a PhD in philosophy from Michigan State University. He's a fellow of the Association for the Advancements of Artificial Intelligence, which is AAAI. He's also a fellow of the American College of Medical Informatics. He's an elected member of the National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine. And he served as treasurer and president of AAAI and chaired the NLM, the National Library of Medicine's study section, as well as their board of scientific counselors. And personally, he's partially responsible for why I'm actually in the field of medical informatics, thanks to the book that he and Ted wrote on role-based expert systems really sucked me into the field of medical artificial intelligence. So it's a great pleasure for me to hear you talk today.
Well, thanks for coming out on such a nice day. This is a rather simple talk, putting together things that you already know, and I hope putting them together in a way that maybe you haven't thought of before, but there's an awful lot going on that takes advantage of both decades of work in AI and the increasing number and accessibility of devices over the web. There are myriad opportunities to be found if you follow the money, and that all presents a new challenge for AI, which I will get to. You know about the X Prize, and this year the prize is $10 million for anyone who develops a medical decision-making program that meets their criteria for diagnosing correctly 15 diseases across 30 patients in 3 days. Simple. $10 million waiting, but that's the old style, and I think that there are new challenges that all of us have a better chance of meeting. So the XPRIZE is focusing on centralizing things, and if medical records were centralized across the country, then whoever wins the XPRIZE would be able to do a wonderful job diagnosing patients across the country. There certainly are big name players, Cerner, Meditech, Siemens, GE. But in this source that I found, the author was expressing some concern that whether the government should play a bigger role in creating uniform technical standards and designs across systems. Almost certainly, if it is centralized, it would ossify, and we would lose an awful lot. Of innovation. So, what's different from the 1970s style medical decision making programs? Well, the internet is the big thing, and that provides interconnectedness of a huge number of devices in addition to people. Crowdsourcing is, we'll get to that. The fact that we're all carrying around mobile devices, and those have both voice and vision capabilities, is new. And the sheer volume of data that's accessible to programs leads to new opportunities. But I think from my point of view, the advances in AI over the last couple of decades in natural language, vision, and speech make as big a difference as any of these other things. So, there are many different kinds of applications. There are an awful lot of reference programs. This one is one of the older ones from Micromedics, and it just looks like a book. They're not taking advantage of the new technology. This one from WebMD looks quite a bit better and much more useful. I didn't know about this program, CIRMO. Does anybody use it by chance? And it looks like it could be very helpful for interconnecting people on consults, and it just ties right into the new idea of crowdsourcing and social networking. You all know about this. This is the only publication in Nature to have 57,000 authors, and it's a prime example of exploiting the game players on the net to do something useful. Do you know the book by Jane McGonigal called Reality is Broken? She cites this program as a good example of turning the interest of game players on the web into something that has some utility. So this is what the people over the web were looking at. And the challenge was essentially play the game to find protein binding sites and how things would have to fold in order to bind. The fact that there are hundreds and thousands probably of devices that are being connected to the web, talking to each other, talking to your phone. You can control lights and appliances from your phone on your way to work, on your way home. And the growth rate, 25% per year in healthcare, it is phenomenal. This I find interesting. If this, if you can fit a device around a heart, becomes just another way of collecting data. There are intelligent shoes that relay where you are, how many steps you're taking, probably how much you weigh. With advances in vision, there are new opportunities. This is just a little iPhone, but it allows you to do some interesting imaging remotely in the absence of big expensive equipment. The number of devices is just astounding. I don't know whether to believe this from Information Week, that 80% of practicing physicians now are using mobile devices. That's what it said. And I found this even more astonishing, that the number of phones that Apple is selling every day outpaces the population growth. The Cerner system, the Cerner Corporation, has this little alerting system, which is one of many that we're going to be seeing. And it's just a very straightforward application. It's the kind of thing that had been going on at Latter-day Saints Hospital 30 years ago, but with big standalone computers. The amount of data available is absolutely staggering. The Amazon is collecting all kinds of information about your buying habits and making it available, but they also have now 250,000 books online. Google saves all the information about your searches and does a huge amount of data mining in order to provide information to people who are buying ads. 33 trillion entries. I mean, these numbers are staggering. And the data mining tools that have been under discussion for 25 years have reached fruition. They work. They're able to cope with that volume of data. So there's no barrier now to having programs that are learning from everything that's out there. The FDA is climbing on board. They understand the value of all of the information they are collecting, and it's going to make a very big difference in the quality of care. Now, mostly all of the data we've been talking about are in structured databases, which makes it much easier for programs and programmers, but there's a huge amount of medical data that's available in text. 1.2 billion clinical documents produced each year. So there needs to be a way of looking at all these kinds of reports that are put into text. Now, at Pitt, the MARS system was started in the 1970s, I think, to capture all of these kinds of records, and so the transcription was done into the equivalent then of Microsoft Word, and it wasn't clear at the time how the text would be used, but they knew it would be useful someday. And then Dr. John Breeze had a great idea that has morphed into what Google does with any number of processors keeping track of all of the information that's out there, every word, every non-stop word in every document, makes it possible to find associations among these kinds of documents that are in text. So the I don't know if you can read, these are years across here from 1990 to 2000 to 2006. The amount of data stored in that system alone is getting to be horrendous. And it's used by everybody in the medical research community at Pitt in order to do retrospective studies and find associations among different groups of patients and their conditions. In order to do that, the HIPAA requirements are that the records are anonymous. And so that was, for a while, a barrier to using all of the text records in MARS, because the researchers were not directly responsible for the care of those patients, and getting signatures after the fact for all those patients was just a logistic nightmare. So Greg Cooper and a number of us looked at the problem of what it would take to read through each of these records and make them anonymous in some intelligent way, so that if Dr. Steve Downs, for instance, is treating a patient, you can know the difference between that and the patient with Downs syndrome, and you can remove the name Dr. Downs and leave Downs syndrome, which obviously is a critical piece of information. But you also need, every time that Dr. Downs is mentioned, or the patient's name, or the spouse's name, to keep the same variable name in there, X, Y, and Z, but use them consistently for those people. We were also alerted to the fact that we needed to be aware that someone who is characterized as a former quarterback of the Pittsburgh Steelers, living in Pittsburgh, that's a fairly small group, and you need to be able to pick out place names, occupation names, and things that would allow to unique identification. So we did that. The system is in daily use. It's actually, Pitt has licensed it to a company that is now selling it. With Wendy Chapman, we also were looking at the problem of distinguishing negated phrases in those text records. So a patient with no history of cancer is somewhat different from a patient with a history of no cancer or no recurring cancer or no more cancer. I mean, all of those things are 101 ways to talk about negative findings or the absence of evidence. And we were trying to sort those out. And what Wendy produced became sort of a standard for a lot of other work on this same problem. Anybody here working on problem of negations? Okay, so you know Wendy's work.
Okay.
Now, IBM's Watson makes good use of statistical natural language processing. It knows a little bit about the world, but mostly it's a tour de force for on the statistical side. It works very well, obviously, but it's working without what we would call any understanding. The UW Health Map program, Dan Macy has pointed me to. Oops, sorry, let me go back to Watson. Watson is reading 200 million pages looking for associations of terms and collecting the numbers of associations of X and Y across all of these to determine that when Y is mentioned, the question is probably about X. There had to be some augmentation. It's not purely statistical, but for the most part, the heart of it is working without any understanding. The Health Map program, does everybody know this program here? I was delighted to find it. But this is some output from the program reading Google News in a few dozen different languages around the world to locate the outbreaks of various diseases. So within 100 miles of Seattle in the past month, whenever I did this a couple weeks ago, there was a GI outbreak. Well, there were several, but January 16th in Victoria, respiratory, January 13th in Collis County, January 13th in Grant County. It's just a way of tracking, but then the interface is an interactive map so that sitting in Seattle, you can see the various outbreaks that are posted in that text report. And if you're interested in any particular disease, you can track it by disease. It's just a wonderful thing. Ben, do you know how widely this is used? Anybody know? It seems like it ought to be on everybody's iPad. Okay, so if we're going to move away from the large centralized standalone medical decision-making programs that we knew and loved many years ago, how can small apps make a difference? And the answer is in the money. So let me just run through quickly some obvious things that you know, but the data on costs becomes staggering and breaking it down. So according to Bill Hirsch, it looked like something around 15% of a physician's time was spent in direct patient care. A lot in paperwork, and he estimated 35 to 40% dealing with information, looking it up or writing it down. Waste in the system is often cited as a major place for cost-cutting. Well, here's how CNN broke down some of the $1.2 trillion that they said was leaking out of the system. A visit to the emergency room, the average costs age dependent, of course, but $1,500 per visit. So writing all this stuff out for insurance companies, I've got the source written down someplace, but whoever it was interviewing this physician was saying what we have all heard many times, namely it's very time-consuming to deal with the insurance companies. Non-compliance is another place where there's a lot of money waiting to be saved. And so failure to follow directions may result in over 300 deaths per day. And if you assume that each death has a cost attached to it, that translates to dollars. $100 billion related to non-compliance, medication-related problems. Perhaps a yearly savings of $80 billion. So we're getting to a point where people are taking notice. Same kinds of problems. The ICU is much more expensive. This study looked at with and without a mechanical ventilator. But the costs are still $3,000 to $4,000 per day after day three. So, what am I suggesting? I'm suggesting that there are niches in any of these large cost areas where a small app that's well designed and used frequently would make a big difference in the cost, and it could make some difference in avoiding medical problems. So let me just run through now some examples that make use of these kinds of numbers as multipliers. If you think of 37 million hospital admissions a year across the U.S., 123 million emergency room visits. Suppose that every admission, the admission clerk was able to save about 5 minutes and in half of the hospitals in the U.S. And it multiplies out to a nice $37 million. Suppose that patients had a little bit of reference on when to visit an emergency room, when to make a phone call, when just to look in Wikipedia. And suppose that you could save a trip to the emergency department 1% of the time. That looks like it would multiply out to $700 million. On compliance, similarly, suppose that patients' medication schedules were available to them on their handheld devices. And so there wasn't that kind of confusion that all patients have, whether the doctor said two white pills in the morning and one red pill at night, or was it the other way around or what. And with a reminder system, take care of all of those kinds of simple errors, just saving a fraction of $100 billion would be some amount of money. Suppose you could fill out save physicians and nurses 5 minutes per form on just a half dozen forms a day. That multiplies out to some large number. I didn't even put the dollars in. Transcription time, well, I think we're getting there because voice recognition is so much better. adverse drug effects, again, if there are 770,000 adverse drug effects per year at over $1 billion, that multiplies out in this way. The Latter-day Saints Hospital actually ran a study, and they would have been able to save $500,000 a year running the study out. This was over 10 years ago. I think things have changed since then. Brigham and Women's is a similar kind of study, but they would have saved $5 million. Wishard Memorial, whatever that number is. But these were actual studies with computer systems that were helping avoid the adverse drug effects. Reminding systems have come into their own in the last 20 years. It's a success story for AI. They're used all over the place, including the kind of recommender systems that Netflix and Amazon use. But Watson is going to be used and has contracted with WellPoint Insurance to just create the medical reminder system analog of Watson's Jeopardy program. Okay, so given all of those opportunities, it's up to people who work within the system, I think, to find the places where an app would be used. Years ago, in the early days of expert systems, we uncovered the awful truth that ignoring the end user was a disaster. And it's just so commonplace now, but we were so certain we knew what people needed that we didn't even need to ask them. One system was built by the General Electric Schenectady AI group to diagnose problems with diesel electric locomotives that had broken down out in the field. And one design requirement from the people in the field was that the screen on the device had to withstand being hit with a wrench, because these people are so frustrated out there. Well, that's not something we would have thought of. And similarly, it isn't something I could think of sitting on Orcas Island. It has to be somebody who's at bedside or at the nurse's station or at the reception desk, in the pharmacy, who knows how these systems would be used, where there is any available time that that could be used for data entry and referring to a device. Okay, so I think we understand pretty well how an AI system can be turned into a recommender system for applications. You look at the text reviews, the text descriptions, the ratings. You read the available stuff on the web, just like these other programs are reading the web to find available information. I think we also understand very well how to rank things. It depends on finding the criteria that are most meaningful in the point of sale, the place where they will be used. What is hard, what isn't checked here, are the specific features to be used, because they are so context dependent. The medical context is where I think we don't understand what's important and how to find it, how to find it, how to define it, and put it into words. Those those things are big challenges. There is a huge problem with the number of apps that already are available. So I was looking to see how many are. Well, just for helping kids, autistic kids, there's a list, or there's several different lists made for parents. They have 400, 500, 600 apps on the list recommended parents could look at to help their kids. That's too many. A physician who wants to recommend an app to a parent may want the best two or three. How do you find those? And one of the parents said, it's daunting to look through there. Well, we know that. I mean, information overload is a huge problem. The number of apps available in Apple's App Store is over 500,000, and it's growing fast. These are apps by area. A very small percentage are in medicine or healthcare, and a lot of the healthcare apps have to do with diet and exercise, those kinds of things. So, not surprisingly, I suppose, the big 17% is for games. That's the point of the McGonagall book, partly. People want to play games. And if you can make these other apps that are socially useful as engaging as the games, then you could get a huge amount of talent already put into designing, implementing these other apps into medically relevant apps. So, 500,000 available in the App Store now, and written by over 100,000 developers, and the rate of increase is. Well, for apps other than games, over 600 a day. So how are you going to keep track of those? You cannot wait until some other parent puts yesterday's app up on a new list. That's just a loser's game. It has to be automated so that as the apps are developed, and as the reviews are written, programs are reading the available information and integrating it with what else is known. And it's not the case that there's going to be one app that's best for everybody, for every autistic child. The context matters, the specifics of the case. So, yes.
I just wanted to ask you the extent to which you think suppliers of the apps really understand the basic care scenario that has been documented in the health informatics standards now for some time with professional discipline input. And it seems, you know, in the Institute of Medicine's report in 203, maybe you're quite familiar with that, and there are five core competencies and how you get patient-centered care with multidisciplinary teams with evidence-based practice and quality management using informatics. And using informatics in the information domain, understanding that and how it contributes to the cognitive processes of the practitioner that's doing the patient-centered care is a key thing. And the Institute of Medicine said, we're not doing that in our educational process, and there hasn't been really good discussion of it, and you see on, even to this day, from the National Committee on Vital Health Statistics and others, Institute of Medicine reports and others, that somehow we're missing the boat, and I'm kind of curious as to how you see these the development of the dialogue between the application suppliers and implementers and the professional disciplines, you know, the healthcare professional disciplines on what we should be doing in terms of, quote, the intelligence, artificial or natural, that really gives them help. I'm just interested if you comment on that.
Well, you don't want a PhD program teaching a lot of courses in how to write apps. That's not the core competency you want to teach. And out of the 136,000 developers, these people will take your design and put it into an app that will run under the operating systems you specify. So I think that the design and the design for a specific niche are what you know. You don't have to know about iOS and all of the complications of getting it implemented. Okay, so what should you be teaching then? And I think those are principles of good design that will be true for the next generation of operating systems as well. So it's the principles that you want people to know.
What you're saying is the conceptual content principles vice the implementing technology and a lot of the technical details of how to make this app behave this way and that way and the next way and that sort of thing. That then is the implementer's task when you get ready to say, this is what I want to get implemented, and they can understand that, then they can understand how to use it.
Okay, but I also want people coming out of the PhD program who are in love with implementing things.
Yeah.
And so when they go home from their day's worth of courses on theoretical work, then these are the ones who are writing the new games. We want them.
No, there is a link, and the question is, how do we develop the productive dialogue between those two perspectives?
We're going to have to go on with this talk to make sure he has
that. I'm almost done here. So let's see. This is a challenge, the number and the rate of growth. And I just wanted to get to a project I'm working on now called NewsFinder, which I think has the germ of some hope here for reading text reviews. And I would love very much to talk to anybody who'd like to work on NewsFinder. We have a summer internship with the AAAI. And one thing I'd like to do is show how this program, which I'm about to tell you about, can be used for information about medical informatics or other field. So do any of you look at the AAAI website, AI in the News? You can subscribe to it. And 5 years ago, I was supervising a webmaster who was manually finding in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Christian Science Monitor, 3, 4, 5 dozen places. They were finding online articles that would be interesting to the AI community and posting them. Ironically, he had a medical accident and was no longer able to continue doing that work. We wanted to continue it. I didn't want to do that myself. And so we asked, could we write a program that would search out the interesting news and filter it so that the AI community would have something every Monday morning with the 2, 3, 4, up to a dozen news items from the popular press that mention AI in some interesting way. Some of those are critical articles, but if they're well written, we want the AAAI audience to know about them. When you do a search on Google News, you're doing keyword searches and you just get too many hits. And there are too many things of very local interest. You know, the Dade County High School robotics team has now advanced to the semifinal. And that's not generally interesting outside of Dade County. So anyway, we're trying to do an intelligent version of Google News. We have 19 categories, agents, representation, reasoning, ethics, history, that are the general categories of interest to people in AI. And we've trained support vector machines for each one of those that will identify from a block of text the degree to which that text represents a story about its topic. So is this a story about the history of computing? So in order to do that, for each text story we've identified, we remove the stop words, and we're left with a vector of somewhere 200 words. And then we apply the support vector machine to assign that topic. We end up with a couple of hundred articles with assigned topics. If no topic can be assigned, then it's probably not interesting. We don't mind missing a few. We think it's much worse to include some real ringers. So we have a list of foul words used in foul language and profanity. So we don't want stories that are containing those. And we have a list of about 100 terms that, unless they're mentioned, unless at least two of those are mentioned, the story is probably not interesting. So we don't want a whole lot of stories about the same thing. If we're just going to give you a dozen, we'd like a diverse set. And we picked a dozen because we figured that's about your tolerance for one email message a week. And so when Watson was being developed, it was interesting to the AI audience, but we only wanted one, maybe two stories a week, not a dozen. So that's the program. What I think we can do this next summer is move from news stories and things that are in the universe of Google News to stories that are good, from the technical literature, that represent good review articles. Those are the ones that you'd like to post on the general AAAI website. That's the website, AI Topics. And that's my mess. So take a look at AAAI.org/AI Topics, and you'll see AI in the news there. We also post whatever we find, the 12 or fewer that are interesting each week. We post them in email Monday morning. We post them on the website for that week. We make them available as RSS feeds you can subscribe to. We can't presume we know how you want to read these articles, but we believe that they are generally interesting. So now if we can find the review articles that cover, say, what's happened with the topic of agents over the last many months, those are worth a lot, and we would like to include those. I believe if we can do that, we can take another field like medical informatics, list the categories related to these support vector machines, train the learning programs to find articles that fit within those categories, and filter them in roughly the same way with some input from people who are knowledgeable in the field. Okay, I think we can use the same NewsFinder procedure to read the reviews and select the best apps as a way out of that challenge of too many apps growing too quickly. Okay, so finding information is what we've been concentrating on for the last 30 or 40 years in medical informatics. I think the next half of the battle is finding the processes that the information processing programs and procedures that will deliver the information in the best way for each context. Thank you. Okay, questions. Wanda, do you want to? Why don't you get started?
Okay, sure. I guess I'll ask my question first. Great. So a lot of what you talk about is looking at maybe more official reviews and sites, but yet part of the success of the web, especially the social web, is kind of the ability for everyday people to post information. Have you thought about how, especially for like apps, you might want to take advantage of the reviews people are writing for apps and things along those lines rather than just the official things? Like Amazon has, its value is partially the reviews that other people write of things and how valuable they are in looking at.
Yes and no. I mean, you want to take that into account. Oh, that's one of the real strengths of Wikipedia, for instance. But it's also, I think, its biggest weakness, because you can get into editing wars with people. I don't know if you've ever tried to edit a Wikipedia article, and as soon as you put up a correction, somebody steps on it and revises it in a way that's 180 degrees from what you intend. So you cannot take what the general public says about something too literally. It makes a difference. It's worth pointing a finger. If somebody says, you know, this app is terrible because, then you might want to look at it and decide for yourself. But you don't want to take it at face value. And the point of the AI Topics website is not to trust Wikipedia. Everything in there has been previously reviewed and published. So it has a lot more credibility than something taken from somebody's blog site. Yeah? You had a question?
Mine was actually really similar.
Okay.
I guess my question was, as far as the news stories go, like Google does a lot of pre-processing of these stories and stores information about how many times this web page has been hit, I'm sure, and aggregates that all into the result ordering they give you. Is there any way to tap into that metadata to help train your SVMs? Because don't they store how many people have like clicked on the site when you bring up their listing, and is that information accessible to you to help train the SVM? Does that make sense?
I'm not following that question.
I think it's like using the popularity information, kind of.
Yeah, because you're getting your news sources from Google.
So, for instance, the Netflix popularity rating.
Not the rating from the user, but the statistics that the service stores themselves. So, Google, if they're presenting you those news listings, they're already aggregating those in a way so they present the most popular one first to you. But it's based on their pre-processing statistics. I don't know if there's any way to access that metadata.
You can play games with that too. And we don't really know what the Google rating system is in its entirety, but it does include the number of times that other people have looked at the information. And that's awfully subject to what's in the news these days. And last week, the number one search term for Google was Whitney. And so, why would you want to know that? So I don't know. Yes, it points a finger to something that one should look at. If there are 500,000 people who found this particular topic or source of information useful, it tells you something. You just want to know what else is out there. So, Wanda, back to the question about what should people be learning. What's the answer?
Everything. That's the challenging part.
You've got to core your curriculum. And does it include programming?
So our particular program requires some programming before you come in.
Uh-huh.
None of our core classes are programming per se classes. Knowledge of presentation builds on some of those topics. But the idea is to give people the flexibility for what their PhD project is going to be about to pursue some of that. And we're likely to have a strong computer science program to pull on for that as well. Well, we're officially out of time, but I'll invite people who want to talk to Bruce to come up after class. Thank you.
You're on a Tuesday.